Yes, today, ladies and gents, is the day you have been waiting for. I know it. You've been on the edge of your seats, biting those nails, stressed out. When is the new season coming? Well, today, my friends, today is the day. Season 3, episode 1, I am joined with a legend, a guy whose focus on the environmental impact of our physical infrastructure, with a focus on the sustainability of our technologies, with the rise of the machines, with the influx of technology today, it's been even more important for us to consider the environmental impacts of our data processing, of data science, of the stuff that we put into the internet and its effect on the real world around us. And even more importantly, its effect on the world that we leave behind. So today, I spoke with a good guy named Max Schulze. And it's not really today, I spoke with him on the 21st of March of 2023. Basically, we focused on issues of data sovereignty, on the need to rethink economic growth, on the need to focus on creating value by shifting the paradigm of how we engage with the world and to do more with less. And so without further ado, I give you Son of a Pitch Podcast, Season 3, Episode 1. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, listeners to the Son of a Pitch podcast, you are joined today with Michael Cuenca and my special guest today. He's very special. I think you'll find that as well as we discover some of the things that are bouncing around in that noggin of his. Max Schulze probably did not fuck this up this time, I hope.
He did very well.
Very welcome to the show. Welcome to this afternoon. Welcome to the end of day ramblings of two gentlemen in the digital economy, digital space. Max, good to see you, man.
Yeah, very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Michael.
Thank you. So, like, for those of us that don't know you yet, what kinds of stuff keeps you busy these days? What are you busy with?
Yeah, that's it. It's a difficult question to give a simple answer, but the field I'm in is, I think, now called digital sustainability. I run a nonprofit, and I think a lot about what does our world today look like with technology and tech and like AI and ChatGPT and data centers and all this versus what did we want it to look like. And that's a lot of my work, is to figure out what's the gap there and trying to close that gap.
So your job is closing the gap between what we thought we knew and what we want to know?
Yeah, there is a Peter Thiel, I think, said it quite nicely. Is we read sci-fi about the year 2023, and there it says we have flying cars. Instead, we got Facebook.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. And this is a little bit like where we're at right now. It's like, yeah, technology is going to solve everything. We're going to digitalize. We're going to innovate. But like, really, like, what's new?
Don't get me started about anyone who's watched Back to the Future recently and realized this is not very much Back to the Future, we'll definitely know. So there's definitely a huge gap between what we thought we would be living in.
And if you like a good example that I think is always interesting, right? We talk about like big tech innovating, but if you really think about it from a business model perspective, Instagram, Google, whatever, they're all advertising, Facebook, they're all advertising based business models. So in that sense, they haven't actually innovated. Advertising has been around for quite a long time.
That's fairly true.
They perfected it. But the business model is the same. The innovation is really just scale.
Is there sort of an impetus that, because I mean, I guess people typically do what's comfortable, right? We do what we're familiar with. Even in exploration, we hold on, at least to some extent, to those things that are familiar to us, the things that are comfortable for us. Is there something in future creation, I guess, that demands us escaping our comfort zone, escaping what's familiar? Or do we necessarily need the familiar to shape the future? Like, where are the limits?
Well, it's this, what do you say? this iterative approach versus disruptive approach. I think in the past we could always go to go step by step, like you the second example that you use, like use the familiar to go forward and just make it a little bit better and a little bit better. Look at the car, right? We made it a little bit more fuel efficient, a little bit. Then we made it electric, still kind of just a little improvement. The interesting question is, do we need cars? Right? That's the interesting one.
Yeah.
And I think,
do we need an evolution or some kind of, I hate this, a revolution, a complete shift? I sound like an innovation strategist.
Our realization of climate change, like the realization that climate change is human made, is actually a great trigger moment to say, well, now we can really rethink things, right? So right now, for example, we know all economic growth on this planet is based on energy use, right? So an increase in energy use increases normally GDP of a country. Well, we can't do that in the future. So now we can design business models around a completely new paradigm, which is, how do we make more money or how do we create more value from a fixed pool of energy and resources without mining more, without taking more from the planet? How do we create value without extracting more, using more energy, you know? And that's introduces a new boundary. And the best innovation, as everybody knows, gets created when you introduce a new box. Like, you cannot leave these constraints, but within those constraints, you can do whatever you want. And now show me how you're going to make money with this box.
There's some terrible German humor there.
Oh, sorry.
About creating new boxes for people to fill into. But
Germans, we like systems, you know.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Where are the forms at, man? Within that construct, though, I think perhaps do we need that kind of mindset shift? Like, can it not be? So in Gestalt psychology, the thought process of, you know, have you ever seen those images of the old woman and the young woman? You know, your mind cannot perceive that same image simultaneously. You know, you can only see the old woman, you can only see the young woman, but you can't see them simultaneously. So in Gestalt psychology, what I'm sort of channeling here is, do we need a sort of clean break, a shift, a qualitative leap of faith into a new sort of construct? Yeah, maybe you called it the new box, but is it? Because I think you were sort of suggesting, in a way, that there's a completely different way of looking at things. Instead of looking at how to improve the car, instead of Ford asking people, do they want a faster horse, do we create a new system?
Yes.
And do we have the means to do that de novo?
Yeah. I think so. I think the simple answer is, I think so. We do have the means. I think it's to maybe get away from the box and use a different analogy. We need to agree on a new truth. And the new truth is that the resources on this planet are finite, right? That's a physical reality. There is a limit of what we can use. It's just how it is. Same as with renewable energy. It's not, even that is not infinite. So with that constraint in mind, we can then move forward. But I think what we see right now in society is that we can't even agree on this fundamental truth, right? We just say, no, we're just gonna make electric cars. Yeah, but you know, the cobalt and the lithium for the batteries is also not infinite. Yeah, but we're gonna innovate and then we're gonna recuperate all these metals. I'm like, yeah, but it's chemically and physically not possible. Like, let's just agree on a new truth that we have to make cars from old cars, for example. We have to be able to completely take an old Mercedes that's 100 years old, put an electric engine in that we took from somewhere else, and we have to get into this new way of thinking. And that's actually not hard. And I think it's very human to think like this, like, how do we salvage this? But it starts with a new truth.
Mm.
To take your picture of the woman, if we can all agree to look at the same spot in the picture, then we all see the same picture at the end.
Right.
But I think in this post-factual society that we're living now, I think it's starting to become very hard to agree on truths. And I'm allowed,
which is ironic, given the fact that we're now more connected than ever.
Yeah, but you know, we still have, when I host events and debates, and we still have these days people that say like, but climate change is not real. Oh, that's just an ice age. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but I'm not debating that. Huh? There's a truth, and that's the truth to me. Right, that's my truth.
Yeah,
and
but how is that? Yeah, that's true. That's your truth. And so your truth is that the globe is warming. Mine, it's just comfy. It's cozy. My truth is someone just left the thermostat a little bit higher than normal, but that's fine. You know,
it's also interesting because those people that don't accept that truth, most of them live in the Northern Hemisphere, which of course impact by climate change is minimal compared to if you live on the equator. I'm sure if you ask people in Pakistan last summer, it's like climate change real to you? They're like, it's 50 degrees Celsius outside. It feels pretty real.
I can cook my food on the sidewalk.
Yeah, it feels pretty real to me.
So looking through some of the stuff that you've done, you work now with a company called SDIA and New Bridge Founders.
Yes.
These are the two shops that you're busy with these days?
Yeah, in a nutshell, it's my New Bridge Founders is literally just me and a friend, angel investing in startups that are active in this field of sustainability, like farming, agriculture. He also does a lot in seaweed and underwater mapping of the oceans, for example. And the SDA is a nonprofit. It's not a charity, but a nonprofit organization, NGO. And there I work on talking about these things, like how do we make the digital world also sustainable? Because my background is originally in IT and software. So I feel like me going into the oil sector and telling them how to be sustainable, that's maybe not my forte, but I can do that in my realm, in my area of competence, and that's IT and software and digital. So I've been doing that for 4 years to help people become sustainable in the digital realm.
In those 4 years, you must have seen some serious shit.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest shifts that you've seen happen? Sorry, that was a terrible Back to the Future quote. What are some of the most significant shifts that you're seeing? And of course, you we're getting the last since November. Obviously, we see the generative AI scenarios that are happening. But what in the last, in a wider perspective, what are some of the things that are really cool and some of the things that are like, oh shit, we really need to pay attention to?
Yeah, I think like on the front end of technology, like what you read in the news, I think not so much interesting has happened. I think there's a lot of hype on very simple technical developments like ML and AI. These are still iterative steps.
Yeah.
I think what's a lot more fascinating is there's a massive attention. So first of all, people realize that the digital world also has physical infrastructure. I think that's a big change. People in the Netherlands, for example, are talking about data centers all of a sudden. And I'm like, wow, you realize that there is actual things that make the digital world work. Geniuses.
This is stored on something.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so digital world has infrastructure. I think that's a new thing. The BBC ran a piece. It's like there's more awareness. And then the second thing is like, and that impact and that physical infrastructure has a massive environmental impact. That's also becoming more clear because servers are not made from wood and recyclable materials. They're made from gold, platinum, cadmium, cobalt, right? It's like everything's in there. And then like companies like Facebook throwing servers away every year. You're like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound so good. So that awareness is interesting. And then the second thing is that a lot of countries and societies are like, and wait, who owns all that infrastructure? And that has created a bit this sovereignty movement of, well, we don't own our data. We don't own the biggest companies in the world are not in Europe and they're all in the US and it's all like five companies. And who actually owns the infrastructure? Oh, wait, that's also like only like 10 companies. Wait a minute, who owns the fiber? And so there's this realization moment coming. And so you see a lot more regulatory activity and talk about what do we do about that? I think that's the second
mega even shift. Beyond GDPR. I mean, because GDPR only it was originally started in 2016, I think. And so that sort of was a watershed in terms of awareness for where our data lies, what companies should do with our data, beyond simply just annoying pop-ups in Europe. GDPR was a turning point for protecting our rights. And frankly, Germany has been a leader in privacy-sensitive, privacy-aware regulations and systems. What are some of the major, what do you think is the biggest implication for these things for how we live our professional lives and how we design the future that we should be living in?
That's a good question. I think so the whole data privacy and security movement is a lot about fear, right? And so it's a lot about like they're doing something to you. I think the underlying problem we haven't solved, and that is that, for example, in the digital consumer space, the main product is attention, your eyeballs. And we allow that business model to exist, to be mined for attention. And for me, it's a very simple thing. It's a societal choice. So we can go and say, we don't want that to exist, and then we can make it go away. But we are not making that choice. From a professional perspective, I think similar things are happening in the professional space, is that we constantly get told that if we don't manage with new technology, we don't move forward as an individual, you know, we're not open to technology, we're not using the latest AI tools, then we're going to be left behind. And this is this techno-centric narrative of forward, 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 and you're all, democracy's too slow, we're asking everybody's too slow, you're the all digital too slow. FOMO. Exactly. And I'm, as a, from a professional perspective, I would refuse, first of all, a lot of these notions. The idea is not to make humans hyper-productive output machines. What no machine has is human ingenuity. And that comes from, example, from being in the same room together and thinking about things together, and synthesizing ideas and generating ideas. Machines can't do that. And they won't for a really, really, really long time. So I would really like us to more focus on where we humans create really unique value and be proud of that and not just feel threatened all day.
So you still use a Nokia 6800, I presume?
No, I use the late. I'm still a nerd. So, but I'm a smart nerd. So I have I have a good phone, but I turn off all the notifications. I'm very deliberate with how I use technology. I'm very aware in that sense.
Well, that was interesting because I was recently in Paris and a good friend of mine, he forgot his wallet. So we went to go buy some stuff or whatever. So I ended up, you know, buying in a couple of things. And so I just whip out my phone like anyone does in Amsterdam and tap it on the NFC reader. And I turned to him like, you have your phone with you though, right? He's like, yeah. Is there a reason why you don't use payment systems? And for me, it dawned on me that something that becomes totally acceptable in one society can be totally abhorred or something to be afraid of in another. Like, do we have these kinds of social divides within the tech sector as well, within how we view and use and implement technology as well? Or is it limited just to social interactions?
That's a good question. I think that technology in itself is a new religion. I think that's how I look at it. I think that in the social context, to just give a funny example, I think I can go very meta, but let's make it really practical. In the social realm, I have the same experience as you. For example, I refuse real-time communication over digital media. What that means is I don't respond to WhatsApp messages quickly. Because for that, there was a phone invented. So if you want something in real time from me, you have to call me, because otherwise I literally check my messages once a day.
That seems fair. That seems reasonable.
But there's so much social pressure. Like, people get really like, yeah, but I messaged you. I asked you if you can have dinner in an hour. And I'm like, why didn't you just call me? Like, why do you expect me? Then I have to look at my phone.
I know you saw it too.
Yeah.
Those two blue ticks are just the bane of communication.
Yes. And it's this, and to that religion point, but if you really think about it, I used to work in IT for more than 15 years. So I spent a lot of time hanging out with nerds. And what's the perfect communication channel medium for nerds is chat and this like async communication. So we're starting to live in this dream world of tech nerds, and they are starting to imprint their values on us, which we then imprint on each other. What, you're not on WhatsApp? You're not using Apple Pay? You're left behind, man. You gotta stay ahead. You gotta embrace technology now.
I didn't even think of that. You know, I started the internet for me started off with IRC, ICQ, these kinds of chat based. I was proud of my 5-digit ICQ number, man. You know, like I was like, yeah, early adopter. And then chat evolved into video, and video evolved into, you know, real time, and real time involved like live streaming. But what's just back to your comment about technology being a religion, if we take this philosophically a little bit, I believe it was Marx that said religion is the opiate of the masses. And if that's the case, if we hold that hypothesis or that presumption to be true, what does that mean for technology?
It means that we are about to witness the forming of a new government.
Right? But is that a terrible thing? I mean, in theory, we have been, over the last few years with crypto, we've been establishing, or blockchain rather, and cryptocurrencies, to be more specific, we've been establishing a new form of cross-border financial flows that didn't require state sovereign identities or verifications, apart from maybe the KYC with IDs that are located, locked to the state. But that's mostly because the state required that. Without going down that rabbit hole, in theory, we have the financial wherewithal or means to exchange value with each other. Same with NFC, same with these things. Doesn't that indeed mean that we can create a new government, a new supranational government system?
Look, I think you're looking at it very technocentric in that sense. I would make it a lot simpler. Yes, we can create you and I can create a government tomorrow, because what is government? It is a group of elected representatives that act on values that we have agreed upon, right?
Yeah, and it's the consensus model.
Exactly. And so democracy is great. It is not optimal, but it's the best way we know how to build something together based on some kind of shared values without leaving everybody, some people behind. It's like, it's not really good, but it's as good as it gets for now. Yeah. And maybe there's different forms of government, but what is missing in the tech discussion is always the word values. What do we value? For example, I value hanging out with people in the real world. I don't want to live in a future where everything is a video call, and I go from the video call into the metaverse, and from the metaverse, I go into my AR glasses to then have dinner with my virtual AI friend. That's not a future that I like. It doesn't really reflect my values. And the problem in the technology world right now is that I can't decide that. I have no influence. I just have to keep swallowing technology at a faster and faster clip. And if I don't do that, I will be left behind. And that's where democracy is powerful, that can basically give power to a lot of people to slow it down. And that's what, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was in the US Parliament and literally said, regulation is too slow to keep up with our innovation pace. And I'm like, that's not possible. Because I understand what you're saying, but you're just saying like, you want to make the rules. You want to build it based on your values, and you don't want to ask anybody in society for their opinion because you're superior to them in your mind. And that's just not democracy. That's dictatorship.
Well, that's revolution, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, then who should be in the lead then?
I don't know. Society. I think nobody, like, why did we create
society? Is indeed the common actor here, though.
Yeah.
For government and for technology companies. Society as consumer, societies as political, as the polis. There's these they are not mutually exclusive necessarily.
But I think for the digital realm, both society, like both civil society, like you and me in our personal roles, as well as government, have never felt as powerless. I think that really technology right now today is happening to us. It's the first, like you, ChatGPT-4 came out. I read immediately there was a Bloomberg article. Prepare your children for their AI friends now. They will have AI friends. They will not have real friends anymore. I'm like, hold on a second. Who decided that?
Yeah, right.
This thing just came out like a week ago, and I'm already like, I already have to prepare
now
as
I
a
have
parent.
To sit down with my kids.
Yeah,
and talk to them about their imaginary watch. Friends that are even more imaginary.
Yeah, and I'm like, let's hold on for 1 second. Let's make a decision on this. Like, what do we want to use this technology for in our society?
Yeah.
And that will slow us down, yes. But to be honest, we're not going to solve climate change with, you know, another ChatGPT-4 or another Facebook. We're not going to innovate our way out of all these problems. The only way we get out of these problems is with agreement with each other, with talking to each other. So in a way, democracy is probably the only way we're going to get there. So let's just stop racing with this stuff. Like, there's no pressure.
Well, I mean, maybe the pressure is indeed what you said, the fear of, you know, missing out, and that itself combined with the speed at which technology accelerates is enough of a propellant to encourage the growth and development, the continuous competition for tech solutions, which is remarkably ironic, seeing that I think I'm reading here, Sam Altman, creator of ChatGPT, the viral AI chatbot you mentioned, is a doomsday prepper.
Of course.
Have you heard about that?
Yeah.
And does that not scare the Jesus out of you? You know, like, does that not make it a little bit curious that the man who will inevitably be creating, you know, Skynet is the very same guy who will be creating dooms? Like, is this, we need a younger Schwarzenegger here? Like, what's going on?
Well, I have to say that at least I am happy that the CTO of the OpenAI organization is a woman. So that makes me happier. But I feel like, so all the CEOs of all the largest tech companies are very strange people, right? They buy islands in New Zealand, they buy passports, they're prepared for like the end of the world. And those are the CEOs of the most powerful media and tech companies in the world right now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, maybe these are not the kind of psychological profiles we want to be running these things.
Right?
Yes.
Well, then maybe that has that. Maybe that's an interesting segue into the kinds of conversations that that you have with regards to sustainability. How does, in our push towards consumption and growth and even more advanced systems, which, as you mentioned, require greater and greater amounts of power throughput, how do you balance the two? The conversation about a sustainable infrastructure, a sustainable economy, with the hunger that we have in driving our technological progress. Like, is sustainability the brakes on progress?
No. I have to say firmly.
You kind of have to say that.
Yes. So sustainability in the not in the marketing sense, but in the how it's defined as these three pillars: economics. So it's balancing the needs of the people, the environment, and economics. So you can also make money in sustainability. There's no shame in that. It just has to be balanced with what environment is requiring of you and what human well-being requires of you. Okay. So just to establish that as the definition of sustainability. Then does it slow us down? No. But it's a good analogy from engineering. And engineers always tell you, just tell me what the constraints are and I'll build you what you need, right? Like, I need an engine that can fly me into space, ideally without exploding. That's a constraint. And with the least amount of energy use possible. And I want to land the rocket at the end as well. Right? Tell that to an engineer. They're like, that's impossible. You say, but I need it. They're like, okay, let me work on it. And that's what sustainability is. It's a new constraint. So make GDP, make economic growth, while energy consumption and resource consumption is stable. That's your constraint. There you go. Now go innovate. That's where innovation really can add something, is when you have new constraints and then you let humanity have a go at it. But you have to introduce the constraint, and that's what we can't even agree on, introducing the constraint.
So are you, in other words, saying that nobody's really, or not none of the real decision makers, have introduced sustainability as a constraint into the equation?
No, because then we would have stopped drilling for oil last year already, right? Like, literally, we know factually that there's more oil in storage than we can burn. We would emit more CO2 than we have set the limit if we burn all oil in storage. Yes. So if we know that's a fact, why are we still making more? Why don't we use up what we have in storage then first? Right? But we're still drilling. We're drilling more than ever. And oil companies are still growing. So to make it really simple, a lot of things are really simple, right? If we want to stop oil and gas, let's outlaw oil and gas companies. Step one, right? Redistribute the profit and the revenue of these companies to society. First constraint identified. But we can't agree on that on the global stage. And nobody wants to make a first step, because if the Netherlands outlaws gas, then it has a disadvantage to other countries that are still using gas. And then you get into this chicken and egg thing. Who goes first? Because we won't go together. It's ridiculous. But it would unleash so much innovation. It would unleash so much innovation, I think, if we just set a constraint. And it would create a completely new prosperity that we can't imagine, because it's always happened. Always.
So I guess that's somewhat of it's very similar to like the entrepreneur's dilemma, or at least people that have started in a sort of a corporate setting and then moved into entrepreneurship. This leap into the unknown.
Constraint of no money.
Well, yeah. But this process that people can jump into that they just really don't know, sometimes maybe that fear and uncertainty itself is the very thing that would be the fuel to create a new system, a new sustainable umfeld, playground, category even. So then what the fuck do we do? It sounds like we're in a fucking stalemate here where, on one hand, we want to push to be innovative. On the other hand, we actually recognize, if you're a thinking human being, there is some impact of, like, anyone that sat too long with a laptop on their lap knows that that shit gets hot, how do you not, how do you translate those very real personal experiences and individual experiences into something that can be transposed into a larger systemic change?
I think there's a simple answer. I think it's about creating, there's a beautiful German word, Leitmotiv, which is a new leading motive. We need to create a picture of what a future looks like in which we have established these constraints and how we are prospering in that future as humans, but also as companies. And then we need to go and create trust and believe in that picture. And then we will move towards it. Right? We cannot, and that's the biggest mistake I think we have right now in this climate debate. We keep shouting at what's wrong, but we haven't created an alternative picture of what a future could look like. I think we can all see us all going extinct. That picture is very clear in our heads, because that's the picture we've been painting through the media. We're all going to die. We've got to do something. There's smoke everywhere. Look at that pollution.
Yeah.
But what is missing is this, like, okay, let's imagine we solve all that, we constrain it. What do we do? What does the world look like? And we need a bit more sci-fi like that.
Yeah, now what?
Yeah. And I think we're missing that vision for that is leitmotif for a sustainable future.
So within that scope, there is room for people like Greta to...
To complain
and throw a shit fit and skip school.
I think you need a conversation starter. It's a little bit like in a party. You needed somebody to start the party, but then you also need some music and it needs some lights, and there's like a bigger picture that you also need to deliver. And now it's time for the big picture. Like, where are we going with this?
So what are we doing wrong? Because, I mean, I would presume you're not the only one out of the billions of people on the earth that kind of thinks this way. Why isn't this sticking?
I think a little bit it's so there is a lot of momentum in the sustainable space when you see like at startups and companies, like how many are emerging, but it's a lot like I called it the capitalist and discovered that there is a sustainability party and crashed into it. And we're like, look, there is an opportunity here. Let's do connect some money. And for example, I'm a good example of this is like monetizing environmental data. Like every company needs like these emission factors to calculate how much emissions there's a lot of startups like monetizing that. And I'm like, that's just wrong. Let's not monetize that. Let's monetize, you know, the solutions to bring those numbers down for a company. That's where but we are too short-term, how do we make money with this focused? And that's another way how we got side-railed. So now the positive picture of our future is that all companies are net zero using certificates and offset schemes. And I'm like, but that's not actually solving the problem, right? Shell can't be net zero. It's just physically not possible. And that's also now happening, but we keep fixing these short-termism problems instead of really saying, like, let's just forget all that. What does it look like if we are successful at stopping climate change, and who benefits, and what will that benefit look like? And I think we ought to have that meta discussion.
Now, on the flip side of things, from this meta level conversation, what about you? You know what? Why? How did you get involved in this kind of process? For someone who started off in technology, it sounds not counterintuitive, but it does sound a little bit, you know, anathema to what the principles that I grew up with knowing. Maybe we grew up with different principles. Maybe I just got it wrong, but. How did you get into this system? Was this like an aha moment where you're like, holy shit, my lap is hot now? What the hell? Or, you know, what was it?
I think it was not an aha moment, but it was a disappointment. I think throughout my career, I've probably built like 100 software projects, like everything, like an online shop where you can rent art and things like this. And when I was young, when I started in tech, which was like 14, 15, I always thought like, oh, this is amazing. This will make people's lives better. My mother was a secretary. I thought like, oh, it's going to save her so much time with automation and digitalization. And it's going to be amazing. What I used to say was, it's going to free us from menial work so that we can really focus on solving really big things and doing fun things together and having more time. And it's going to be incredible. And then 15 years later, I was like, we're not on track for that.
Yeah. When is that going to happen?
Yeah. And it just got, people got more like, you sit in conversations now and people are like on their phone while you're talking to them. I'm like, that's not why I made that. You know, I wanted it to be in the background doing stuff. So you and I can just have a conversation, like take a simple thing. How many startups have you seen that were automating meeting scheduling for you, like all these little tools? It still doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that should work. Why do I still need to have these email conversations about scheduling a meeting with people that machines can do a lot more efficiently than me? I was really disappointed. And I realized that this pace of innovation that is always like at the forefront of the discussion is sometimes moving us away from actual usefulness.
Mm.
We're innovating for the sake of innovation.
And not necessarily for the sake of enhancing utility or functionality or growth.
No.
So is this just like an echo of the bubble? Of the tech bubble of the 2000s? You know, is this sort of what's become of us now, you know, where we are stuck in this eddy of ongoing, like, sort of just a black hole of, you know, once we solve this one little thing, then we go into another little thing, and then we go into even more, like, are we diving down, like, this rabbit hole of minutia? Or what does it take to switch people's mindset to stop looking down at utility and looking up at, you know, thriving? I'm sort of channeling the donut model conversations here. How do we thrive within that construct that you're talking about and develop systems that actually help us become better humans?
I think we just have, we have to say so. We have to make it so. Let's take tech as an example. We often talk about it as if it's like this abstract thing, you know. Oh, I have to use Instagram because that's where customers are, and it just works like this because that's how it is. And we have to go there, or like metaphysically speaking, like we have to go to the tech community and say, sorry, but that's not what we ordered. Huh? What we wanted was technology that makes our lives better. This is, sorry, but that's not it. And not just take it as it is and let it happen to us, but we have to play an active role, and we have to look at it and say, we as society have to say, that's not what we need right now.
Yeah.
Sorry, we needed something else. We don't like advertising. I don't want to be mined for attention. Please stop. I don't want it.
Right? There should be another. I mean, decades ago, Milli Vanilli got turned out for lip-syncing music, and lo and behold, they were just a little too early.
Yeah.
In comes TikTok with teenagers dancing and lip-syncing poorly to music. They're probably just like, fucking hell.
Yeah.
And so in your own personal, you were just disappointed. You were kind of like, this is like you said, this is not what we ordered. Do we need to change restaurants?
No.
Do we need to go somewhere else? Do we need to cook at home? Like, what is this? It's like, are we seeing ourselves now at a turning point where we have to go back to, you know, the foundations of humankind and how we first made those connections? Because there is this countering force that I'm hearing from you, that despite the forward thrust of innovation and technology for innovation and technology's sake, there's seemingly an undercurrent of real human value in the natural. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think so. Do we have to go to a different restaurant? No. I think we have to sometimes send the food back.
That's fair.
And we have to teach tech about values.
So this can't be in the UK because they don't send food back there. No. Sorry.
But if you think about
it. Oh, no, it's lovely. I love fingers in soup. It's delicious.
If you think about so tech, and that's a really interesting one, right? So tech always claims to be neutral. So a good example is open source technology. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah.
But in the licensing, it always says, if you do something with this and it breaks or it doesn't work, we are not liable, right? Which makes sense.
Sure.
But so, for example, if now I use an open source database to power my tank or my drone that kills people, the open source community says, well, that's not our responsibility. Well, if I make a car and the braking system doesn't work and my friends are dying, I can't say, well, the braking system was open source. You could have fixed it yourself. I'm not responsible, right? That seems illogical. But in the tech world, there's neither values nor accountability. I'll give you another example. I don't know if you realize this, but the standard that runs the internet, the HTTPS, right? That's a protocol that's run by the W3C, the World Wide Web thing.
Consortium.
That's not a legal entity, yeah?
No, it's a public.
It's nothing. You can't sue. Like, if the HTTP stops working, you can't sue it. You can't hold it accountable because it's not it's not in our legal framework. It's neither a foundation, nor is it a nonprofit, nor is it a company. It's nothing.
It's just a group of guys that call themselves the W3C.
Yep. And that's what the entire internet runs. I just wonder.
Right?
Because. And tech has so far always evaded this system of values, of law. And law, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's just philosophy. Let's just agree what we want and what we don't want. But it's time that we as society say, hey, guys, we already agreed on values like, you know, human dignity, freedom, equality. Would be great if you guys could embody that into your products, right? Because that's kind of what we agreed on.
That's insane. That is insane. I didn't actually know that. Oh my goodness.
Don't look into the governance structure of the internet. You will be disappointed if you, it's actually good in a way because, for example, all the internet hubs are also nonprofits.
Right.
So it's a really strange thing, but sometimes it's devastating me how little people understand how the internet works and that it's not, you know, something that the government somehow runs and controls or makes sure it works, but we're building our entire economy on top of it. And I'm like, not sure.
So does that mean that, when you enter the metaverse conversations, you end up with, you know, similar, they're usually founded on blockchain systems, right? And these are private entities.
Yes.
Does it mean for a global system like those to exist, it needs to be a non-entity kind of thing? Like, do we need to just not like absolve ourselves of any responsibility in order to take a responsible approach to creating tomorrow?
No, I think it's the opposite. I think we need to know who's responsible for what. Because if the internet doesn't work, and let's say we connected all our hospitals to the internet and they all can only function when they have internet connection, somebody needs to be responsible, because otherwise our society doesn't work, right? It's like checks and balances.
Okay.
You gotta have it. And the blockchain, by the way, is great for that, because the blockchain is in itself the most transparent transaction ledger in itself that cannot be manipulated. What a lot of people don't understand is that it's perfect in terms of accountability, because I know exactly who did what.
But on the flip side, it's fucking horrible in terms of environmental sustainability.
Yeah, proof of work. Yes.
Work systems, not the new Ethereum systems that are in place and the new other systems in there. But the big guy, the blockchain, the giant elephant in the room that's created by no one, ironically, or some random people they think that exist, that is still quite damaging.
It is on a scale that a lot of people would like. The International Energy Agency now actually breaks out the numbers of energy consumption of crypto. They used to mix that in with data centers, and it was always very confusing. And it has been growing 2,400% over the last 2 years, I think. And I posted it. It's like multiple gigawatts of energy per year are going into mining. And again, not something that society decided to do, right? It just happened. And I'm like, maybe next time we could have a democratic decision on that before we waste like gigawatt scale energy on something. If I want to build a steel mill in Germany or in the Netherlands, I have to get approval from the government, is how it works, right? If I build a crypto farm in Norway, I don't. Because the government doesn't understand what I'm doing.
Damn. So then we can actually play with global asymmetries of information to mess
with. That's what tech has always been doing. I think I always make this joke, you know, as an IT guy, I can switch to IT language. I can be like, ooh, you guys, we need to really urgently update that database system, because otherwise we have like a security threat in there. And I need about 100K right now to just fix that bug. And like, nobody can prove that I'm lying or I'm like making shit up.
Like, all sounds reasonable.
It. Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, you said security. He needs money. Database. Said, we do
I
have
heard
a database.
Bug, I heard security. I heard TCP/IP systems. My brain shut down, and I just like, oh, take my money.
Exactly. And so that's what tech has been getting away with for a long time. Also, with a laziness of people not wanting to understand it. Right. Let's be honest. People just, I say IT, and people are like, oh God, you lost me at the I.
No, but you're totally right. So I'm reading over here. There's headlines from the magazine Nature Climate Change, basically said that projected Bitcoin usage, should it follow the rate of adoption of other broadly adopted technologies, could alone produce enough CO2 emissions to push warming above 2 degrees Celsius within less than 3 decades.
That's just
Bitcoin. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of different cryptocurrencies out there using these very same systems.
Yeah. Now you know why my job is so fun, because it's only good news.
So then how do you go to sleep at night?
With humor. So I think one of the biggest mistakes we do sometimes in society is that we take things a bit too seriously, and that it becomes this interpersonal war of ideas. And my personality type is called the debater. I love debating. I'm happy to take any position. I don't feel politically personally attacked. And I take a lot of things also in this, you hear me now, I take him a bit with humor and sarcasm, because it's a good way to cope with sometimes the insanity of what I know is true.
Okay.
And I think it's helpful to not make everything, you know, we're still human beings. It, you know, even if we have a debate about, you know, should there be monopolies or not and blah, it's not personal. It's not about you. It's about, you know, constructs.
Huh. Okay, well then what's next? What do we need to focus on next to actually, so there's this, I remember seeing this video on a system that shall not be named. It was also on the BBC. I think it was the fox, the mole, the horse, and the something. I don't know. It doesn't matter. There's this one comment where, you know, you're looking ahead and it's a mist. You can't see too far ahead of you. But the question that I think the mole asked was, can you see your next step?
Yeah.
Can you see what the next step is? And if so, then take that. You don't have to be overwhelmed by what the future might hold or might not hold, but rather what the next step you need to take in order to get to your destination. So in our restaurant, let's say, whether we're sending dishes back or consuming them writ large, what is our next step in the evolution of what we need to be focusing on? What we need to be doing to give, let's say, I mean, we both have kids, to give our kids a better chance at enjoying and thriving in the world.
Yeah, so we talked about constraints earlier, and now I'm going to give you the simplest answer that you will laugh at, probably. I think the next step is for us to get together in different groups of people with different backgrounds and different from different layers of society and talk about what we want and what we want the digital future to look like and what our future in general to look like, and what constraints we're willing to endure. And I think we need to debate that as in a very, so to say, very democratic way. We need to get in a room together, talk about it, decide it, and then communicate to the government that this is what we would like, and then push for the implementation of that. So people in a room talking and then communicate.
The debater suggests that we debate.
Yes.
It's a fitting recommendation given your perspective. But yeah, no, I don't, that doesn't seem unreasonable. And I think we have the technology.
There you go. You're walking advertising.
I know, right? We have the technology to hurl that scimitar into the screens of the drones. That's very interesting. I keep getting reminded. Yeah.
But you're right. Like, we have a lot of technology that helps us amplify messaging.
Yeah.
And so let's use that for communicating clearly into the technocentric or into the tech world, what we as society would like tech to look like in the future. I find that people always like, but Max, you're using all the technology. Why are you on LinkedIn? Why are you doing this? Yeah. Like, there's no, I still have to use it to get my job done as well. There's no, I'm not gonna, I can't change that. But ultimately, it's about really getting together and making decisions together as people and feel empowered that we can, because we are allowed. We are allowed to say, no, that's not what we wanted. Yeah. Sorry, we don't like that. We want to be more, we only want to work 4 days a week or 4 hours a day, and we want the AI to do the work for us instead. Can you make that work instead of me having to tell the AI what to do? I don't know. I'm just making things up.
No, but that doesn't sound like a stupid thing, man. Like, if in theory, I only had to work a morning a week, and honestly live a very comfortable lifestyle, be able to eat what I want, cook what I want, spend time with my kids, do all the things, and not like, I love what I do. Don't get me wrong. I love helping people and working with them, and the job. I don't feel like it's a job, but the job that I do. But if I could switch that, and not like in the, I just, you know, I'm like the first coder for Uber and I just had an exit kind of situation, but in the sense of like, there are systems in place that keep the world running and reliably so in a sustainable and healthy way. I mean, think we got that in subsistence farming? You know, like,
didn't we fuck it up? Simpler. Like, here, you're an entrepreneur, and everybody who's an entrepreneur will get this, right?
Yeah.
Accounting. For Christ's sake, why do I have to scan receipts and put them in a category and say that this is a restaurant bill? Like, of all this thing you read in the news, I'm like, what is the most meaningless work I have to do every single day is admin and accounting. Why are you not doing that away? And I have this outstanding bet that I said I will give all my money to the first founder who will automate accounting for me. And I've been looking for 5 years and I'm yet to find a company that can really just make, you know, it for an entrepreneur, take the whole accounting thing completely away.
What do you mean take it away?
Yeah, like completely automated. Like you just put, I don't know, you throw, you have your scan snap scanner, throw your receipts in there, you scan them. And then from that point on, it gets detected automatically, filed automatically, put in your accounting software automatically, sent to your tax files automatically, completely perfect without that you have to manually check anything. Downloads your bank account
until
statements.
You said manually check, because...
Yeah, no manual checking.
I've actually automated my system using make.com by just taking a photo. It uploads to a Dropbox. That Dropbox is monitored. That then gets sent to Exact Online, where my accountant and their teams go through it, categorize it, file my reports for me and everything. But that's why
you
I pay
still
the accountant.
Check it. Yeah.
They still have to check it. I don't have to check it. So for me, it's just like, click. All right, forget it. And then, of course, being the entrepreneur I am, like, oh, I'll scan it later. I'll just shove the receipt in my pocket. I'll get home. Then later, maybe I'll scan it. So maybe at the point of purchase, hey, it looks like you're at a restaurant. If Google can know that I'm at a restaurant and ask me to review it afterwards.
Exactly.
If I buy when I'm there, when I'm right there, you know I'm there.
Why do we get paper receipts?
Yes.
Like everybody talks about the paperless this, paperless this. I'm like, receipts, really? Like, I paid with a card, especially in the Netherlands, there's basically no more cash. So everything is recorded. Like the card knows I paid there. The payment system knows with which card I paid. And still I get this paper thing.
No, but on the, just to recap the kinds of the conversation we've gone through today, we are as a species rushing towards greater technological advancements, Moore's law, our own sense of FOMO for new technologies. Countered, if not supported by, this push towards a more sustainable mindset. And in your mind, what would solve all of that is basically us using the very technologies, even though you don't, you prefer asynchronous, using the very technologies that'll bring us together to establish a shared understanding of what matters to us as a human species. And just set that up. Can we do that within our generation or the next few generations?
No, this will happen. This needs to happen now. I think now we are at the inflection point where the acceleration of digital technology is so fast that now we ought to make some choices, because otherwise we'll lose track. We will lose the opportunity to change the track it will go towards. So this is you and me now. We have to do that.
I'm leaving silence because I'm certainly editing that bit, because that's quality right there. Max, I don't want to take too much of your time, but for those of us on the internets, that would want to learn more either about what you're talking about or about the work that you're doing, how could they do that? What's a good couple of places they could start?
So on our website, SCIA.io, we have from the nonprofit, we have a knowledge hub. There's a lot of reading stuff that you can go through, and sometimes it's very overwhelming. So you can send me an email if you want, and I'll help you find content that's relevant to you. I think there's also, I do a lot of very provocative stuff on LinkedIn. So come join me there and our organization.
Yeah, that's how we met.
Yeah, exactly. And it just, I think ask questions also on social media, on like when big tech companies say something, really think about, does this benefit me in the way that I had imagined? And ask them like, what was the intention here for me? And not just try to apply it right away. I think that's the most important message.
Awesome. Well, Max, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. This has been a really cool conversation. I was looking forward to this for quite some time now. So, Dankeschön.
Dankeschön.
I hope that this, for the people out there in podcast line, was equally thrilling and riveting. If not, you're not going to get that hour back. So sorry, guys. But otherwise, thanks again. Wishing you all the best. And hopefully that some of the stuff that we talked about today would actually come to fruition and we can actually start making some real changes and real differences. Is there anything you wanted to leave as we wrap things up?
No, I just want to say thank you, Michael. I always have good conversations when people ask good questions. And that's for me, 75% is the good question. So I appreciate you asking thoughtful and provocative questions. Thank you.
42, baby.